So tonight's talk is called The Four Messengers. This is sort of it's a very classic Buddhist teaching, and it speaks to why did the Buddha do what he did? I mean, the Buddha was in his early years, I mean, he was a prince, right? He lived in a palace. He had everything you could imagine that anyone would ever want. He had a wife, he had a child, he had, you know, friends, relatives. And in addition, so the story goes, his father was sort of overprotective and wanted to make sure that his son's life was just wonderful all the time. Never anything that might disturb him or upset him should ever happen. He should just always have this really wonderful sort of golden life, right? And that was fine for a while. And then the Buddha got a little sort of restless, I guess, living in this sort of cloistered palace sort of world, and wanted to sort of see what the outside world was like a little bit, you know, outside the palace compound. And his father agreed that he could do this, but he had to go with guards and he had to go on a horse. He couldn't just walk around, you know, like a regular person. And he had to have some guards with him. So next day he rides out with his guards and they're just sort of riding along. He's checking, oh, look at all this stuff that's out here in this world inside the palace. And he sees this person who's sort of all sort of bent over and their skin is all wrinkled and one of their hands is sort of squished in a funny looking way and their hair's all white and gray and not that much hair left. And he goes to the captain of the guard and he says, "What's that?" Because he'd never seen anyone like this. And the guard says, "Oh, that's a old person. That's a person. That's what, you know, what an old, as you get older, that's what ends up happens. You end up looking more like that." Buddha sort of took this in. He was a bit shocked. And so the next week they ride out again and they're riding along. And there's this person sitting beside the road. At least he thinks it's the person because this person's like all covered in sores and the sores are sort of oozing. And it's like really disgusting. And the Buddha says, "What?" to the captain. "Well, what's that?" And the captain says, "Oh, that's someone who's ill. He's got some, you know, ulcerative skin disease of some sort. And that happens to people all the time." And the Buddha, "Wow, that's like, this is really," now he's really starting to freak out. But he sort of takes that in, and now he's mulling this over, thinking about the fact that people get old and people get sick. And then the next week they ride out again and he sees a whole bunch of people walking in a procession, except one person is lying on this sort of bed that they're carrying and the person's sort of laid out on this bed covered with flowers and stuff. And a lot of the people who are in the procession are weeping and crying and wailing. And the Buddha, he turns to his guard and says, what's that? And the guard says, "Well, you know, that's, that person's dead. That's a corpse. That, you know, people die. This is what," and they're taking him to the ghats to be burned. And at this point, the Buddha's like, "Oh my God, this is like," and the guard says, "Well, this is what happens to everyone dies." And the Buddha is just, at this point, he's just like really freaked out. And he's like, "Oh my God, this is like, everybody gets old, everybody can get sick, everybody dies." It's like, he never knew any of this stuff. And it's really like, he sort of discovers that the world is full of this unpleasant stuff. It isn't, his life is not representative of the world. And all those people around him and himself are included in what's coming. And he's just like, doesn't know what to do. He's really confused and he's really upset. But they ride out again the next week. And he sees this man in the marketplace and he's just standing there. He's dressed in this really plain, simple robe. He's got a staff and he's got a bowl. And he's got the biggest smile on his face. He's sort of old and tatty looking, but he looks really happy. And the Buddha stops and he says, how come you're so happy? I mean, you're old and you're sort of weathered and broken down and you don't have anything. Obviously, you just got this bowl and the staff and this one ratty looking robe. And this person explains that he's a renunciate, a monk, and that he's found a way to be okay with what's going on in the world. And so the Buddha asks him a bunch of questions. And it's like, there's something, I can actually do something so that I don't have to suffer. So those are the four messengers. The old person, sick person, the dead person, and the renunciate. Those are the four messengers that the Buddha connected with. And from that connection, he went, okay, I got to do something about it. That renunciate looked like he really knew what was going on. I have to become a renunciate. And he told his parents, and his parents, of course, freaked out and said, well, you're the prince, you know, you're going to inherit the whole kingdom. What about your wife and kid? And you know, you got to carry on the line. And you know, so you're supposed to, you're a warrior. He was of the warrior caste. You're supposed to like lead the army. And the Buddha finally just quite literally ran away from home, went out into the world and became a renunciate. And then the rest of the story goes on. But it was those four messengers that set him off on that journey. The interesting thing about this story is that in the West, in our Western world of teaching Buddhist stuff, we often ignore the first three messengers and only talk about the fourth one. We talk about meditation a lot. That's sort of the main theme of a lot of teaching and goes on. But ignore the fact that there was three messengers that came before that. And this is a lot of what this talk is going to be about, is why is that? I want to read a Hafiz poem, because this Hafiz speaks to this quite nicely. This is called Tired of Speaking Sweetly. Love wants to reach out and manhandle us, break all our teacup talk of God. If you had the courage and could give the beloved his choice, some nights he would just drag you around the room by your hair, ripping from your grip all those toys in the world that bring you no joy. Love sometimes gets tired of speaking sweetly and wants to rip to shreds all your erroneous notions of truth. They make you fight with yourself, dear one, and with others, causing the world to weep on too many fine days. God wants to manhandle us, lock us inside a tiny room with himself, and practice his dropkick. The beloved wants to do us a great favor, hold us upside down, and shake all the nonsense out. But when we hear he is in such a playful, drunken mood, most everyone I know quickly packs their bags and hightails it out of town. That's what we do mentally. We don't want to talk about the first three messengers. We don't want to hear about the first three messengers because it's unpleasant. It's like, ooh, who wants to talk about that stuff? You know, I did hospice work for a number of years, as a volunteer. And people, I can't tell you the number of times when I told people that they sort of went, "Ooh, how could you possibly do that? I mean, be around these people who are dying all the time, and just like, how could you want to do that?" And it was actually quite wonderful in terms of learning about the truth of the four messengers, among other things. But it was like that was the reaction I got many, many times. "Ooh, this is like, we only want the pleasant stuff. We want, oh, those calm and peaceful states that arise as we meditate, right? We want the sangha and all those nice people we get to hang out with. But we don't want the other unpleasant stuff." I had an Indian teacher a long time ago, back in the 80s, 70s and 80s, Swami Vishnudevananda. And he had this sort of standard question he used to ask all the time when he'd get a big gathering of students together. And the sort of the understanding was, if you knew the answer to the question, you weren't supposed to say anything, because there's always new people there who would, and he'd say, the question was, "What's the difference between yesterday and today?" And people would say, "Well, Swamiji, yesterday was Wednesday, today's Thursday," or, "Today was cold yesterday and it's kind of sunny and nice today," or, all those sort of answers, right? He'd say, no. "The difference between yesterday and today is today you're one day closer to death." And everybody, this is, I'm in my 30s. I would go, "Oh, God, he's so depressing." It was like, "Ooh, who wants to hear that?" But what he was trying to do, and I eventually realized this, is he's trying to wake us up. We don't know. We have no idea when that next day is going to come, or if the next day is going to come. And he was trying to wake us up to get us to practice, take our practice seriously. That's what he was trying to do over and over and over again. He would do this. And gradually, for me at least, it sunk in. But there was always people who complained. I would have people come and complain to me, because I got to be more senior in his organization, and they would become, "Oh, he's always so depressing, talking about all this death all the time." And I'd explain to them why, and they'd sort of go, "Oh, okay." But it's like, I want only the sweet stuff. I want to, this is a group that did a lot of kirtan and chanting, and it was very sort of uplifting and holy. And that's what people wanted. They didn't want to hear about death, sickness, old age. And now what I'm going to say might be a little politically incorrect, but I'm going to say it anyway. This is part of the problem with what I'll call the mindfulness movement in the world today. Where mindfulness has sort of almost become like one of those words that it has lost its meaning. It's become sort of this cool thing, right? And it's taking sati, mindfulness, out of its original context. And mind, a lot of what goes on in the mindfulness movement, if we're not careful, has to do with feeling good, looking good, being better. I mean, football teams now have mindfulness coaches. I mean, give me a break. But that's what's going on. It's like mindfulness is now being used as a way to sort of make you more productive and all this sort of stuff. It's only the fourth messenger. The other three messengers, I'm telling you, I bet you any money those other three messengers aren't mentioned to the football teams. I mean, it ain't gonna happen. And that's it's another example is there's a magazine out now. It's been out for a number of years, I guess. Now it's called Mindful. I sort of was curious. Oh, look, a magazine on mindfulness. How cool! I looked at it. Only reference to the Buddha in that particular issue was in the ad selling statues of the Buddha. That was it. It's like, once again, let's take this mindfulness as sort of this cool thing that doesn't, it's now lost its roots. It's lost its context completely. And I know there's arguments on the other side, well, this is like a good way for people get started with mindfulness and then they get interested and then they'll go deeper. And I understand that argument. I don't think it's particularly valid, but I understand it. I saw exactly the same thing. I was involved in yoga for many, many years. Still practice, actually. And I saw that argument over and over and over and over again about sort of this hip, you know, Thai Bo yoga dance classes and things like that, that totally separated yoga from the tradition that it came from. And that's what happens sometimes with the mindfulness movement. Now, having said that, I will also say that mindfulness can very skillfully be wedded with Western psychology, for instance, where the teachings are kept in context, but expressed in a way that people with a Western background might understand more clearly. This is wonderful. You know, I mean, and there are wonderful teachers. About half of the teachers in the people I know who teach are therapists. I mean, David Chernikoff and Peter Williams and immediately here in the IMCC world are both therapists, for instance. Terry Ray is another. So there's lots of, it can be very skillfully connected. And in a sense, and this is quite interesting, I think. I was at a retreat with Joseph Goldstein, and someone asked the question about what's different about Western Buddhism, because Western Buddhism is a distinct form of Buddhist practice and teaching at this point. And that's a wonderful thing about Buddhism. You know, what the Buddha taught 2,500 years ago, but that teaching can sort of be taken and blended with other things. And that's what happened in Tibet, you know, where the Tibetan people around 900 AD came in contact with Buddhist teachings and Buddhism moved into Tibet. But there was already this very powerful tradition called Bon, which had a lot of deity forms and those sorts of things, and a lot of very traditional practices. And so if you look at Tibetan Buddhism, you know, and all of the bodhisattvas are actually, if you look at them underneath and how they're described, often they are pretty much identical to Hindu deities, for instance, and so on. So they in the Tibetan practice, the teachings of the Buddha got blended with this very powerful tradition and this form of Buddhism called Tibetan, which of course has many different forms. Even, you know, at this point, it's not saying Tibetan Buddhism is sort of like saying Christianity. Well, there's actually many different forms and different practices in the Tibetan world. And the same thing happened in when it got Buddhism got to Japan, and there's this very sort of fierce samurai warrior tradition, and what you get is Zen, which is very fierce practice and very sort of formalized and do this exactly this way, you know, everything. Once again, wonderful. It's different. So in the West, when Joseph was asked, how is Western Buddhism different? He said two main things make it different. One is the blending of the Western psychological understanding and the Buddhist teachings. Because the Buddha was actually, if you think about it, if you think about him in one way, just an amazing psychologist. He really understood how your mind works. And that's what, and it's through that understanding of how our minds work that we learn to work with the mind skillfully so we don't get run over by it. So it makes sense from in the West that that this blend is has occurred and is occurring. And then he said the other thing that makes Western Buddhism unique is its feminization, the fact that many of the teachers are women, which certainly in traditional Buddhist cultures isn't what's happening to this day, isn't what's happening. And there are patriarchal rules that people quote to make sure it doesn't happen. And there are exceptions. There are some quite powerful women teachers in this lineage, but not that many. Whereas in the West, it's been very conscious from the very beginning that the teaching is done equally by men and women. When I go on long retreats at either Spirit Rock or Insight Meditation Society, half the teachers are men and half the teachers are women. It's like it's an unwritten rule, but it's always that way. It's very consciously done that the feminine energy and the feminine expression of these teachings is there. And that's shifted how this practice is taught in the West. So I guess I went through all of this just because I don't want to feel anyway. I'm like I'm dissing the mindfulness movement. There are aspects of the mindfulness movement that I think are not that particularly skillful or useful, but there's also a lot of what goes on within that culture that I think is very useful and very skillful. And it's just this form of Buddhism, this Western form, is arising. As I mean, we're all part of the arising of this form. It's only been 50 years, which is nothing in terms of the Buddhism. I mean, 2,500 years later, here we are. So 50 years, it's like, well, we're just maybe getting a good beginning. Who knows where this is going to go? Right? If what Joseph is talking about isn't true, then mindfulness just becomes another thing to consume. It's like another thing you can buy something, you know, go to mindfulness, you can get the right murti for your, you know, your meditation room and, you know, pay a lot of money and go to some course by some person and blah, blah, blah. It becomes just not that useful, I think, and lacking the grounding that's necessary. Lacking the, for instance, not talking about the first three messengers. And it's sort of like mindfulness turns into this sort of sweet, palliative process to make you feel good. It's like, let's put a big Band-Aid over this problem called mindfulness. You know, may I remind you, the Band-Aid isn't that effective because the problem is a gaping wound in our psyche that we have to learn to deal with. And so, okay, so that's part one of this talk, laying the groundwork. Now what I want you to do, and this is the part where I want you all to write something. And what I want you to write is I want you to think about five things that are really important to you. And not, don't be sort of esoteric or generic, like, oh, peace in the world. No. These are something that, you know, it's got to be five things that you think are for you, things that you really hold dearly and think are really important. Things that you really like, maybe it's like things you like doing, relationships that are really important to you, pets, food, who knows? Just whatever is really five things. Just, and don't spend a long, don't, this doesn't have to be the perfect list of five things. Just pick, it'll come to mind. It's pretty hard not to be able to think of five things you really like and think are important. So just write them down, five things. And I'll give you a minute or so here. I'll even not talk for a minute while you write. You all look like you're still writing. I'll give you another minute. Like I said, don't try and make it a masterpiece list. It's just five things that come fairly quickly to mind that stick out in your mind. It's like, yeah, that's important. This is really important to me. Okay, how's everybody? Is everybody, anybody, if you're not finished, wave your hand so I'll know you're not finished. Everybody's finished. Okay, so now what I'm going to do is I'm going to sort of go around and ask some of you, maybe all of you, who knows, to read one item on your list. And I'll ask actually for a particular item. So I'll start with Sherry. Can you just turn on your mic and just read out the third item on your list?
Learning.
Learning. Okay. And then Diane, can you read the second item on your list? Oh, your mic isn't on. Can you turn your mic on? Don't have a mic? Ah, there we go.
Okay, the second item is
Yeah.
friendships.
Friendship. Okay. And then Carolyn, can you read the first item on your list?
The first item on my list is connection with a power greater than me and my spiritual journey.
Okay. You guys are being pretty generic so far. I just thought I'd point that out. Okay, Deborah, let's see how you did. Number four.
Cooking.
Cooking. Ah, yeah, that's a good one. Okay, and Carolyn, you were so generic, I'm going to give you a chance to do another one. Give me number five on your list.
Yoga.
Yoga. Okay. So now, what I want you to do, those of you, remember which one I told you, I want you to cross that one out. Just black it right out, or the couple of them in some cases, black them both out.
So sorry to jump in, but you didn't get to me, so I don't black anything out.
Yeah, that's right. You don't block. I did that intentionally. Don't worry.
Okay, good. I wasn't sure if
Okay.
it was part of the plan.
No. Yeah, it was definitely part of my. I'm being very sneaky. Okay, so now I want you to think very carefully about what I'm about to say. This is what happens to people all the time. Things that you think are really important disappear from the list of things you can actually do because you get old, because you get sick. They just disappear off the list. So just think what now think what it's like that one that was on your list is gone. You can't deal with that stuff anymore. You can't do that anymore. This is the reality of the first three messengers that we, and why it's so unpleasant. Because we don't like the fact that this happens. As it's happening, we really don't like it, let me tell you. And here's another thing that Meredith so quietly pointed out. This is a totally random process. Some people didn't have to cross out anything yet. Other people had to cross out too. This is the way this happens to everyone is totally out of your control, totally random. It's not in any sense of the word fair. Life isn't fair when it comes to this stuff. We want it, we somehow think, oh, everything's going to be fair, right and sweet, and everything's going to be great. But it isn't. It's totally arbitrary. And which one you lost, which one you had to cross out was like, pfft, I was just Barry calling out numbers, right? That's what life is. Barry calling out numbers, and you lose those ones, just like that. And it's like, life just isn't fair. It just doesn't work out that way. For some people, you know, all of a sudden they lose 3 out of the 5, just like that. And other people, they sort of gradually leak away. But in the end, all the things on your list are going to be gone. Every one of them is going to be gone. I guarantee you that's true. That's the nature of the three messengers. That's what the three messengers are saying over and over and over again. You know that nice list of all those things you like so much? They're all going to be gone. Absolutely going to happen. And we don't want to think about that. In fact, our culture strongly discourages us from thinking about that. But I'll tell you, when I did hospice work, I spent a lot of time just sort of like hanging out with people talking. And a sentence of this form occurred over and over and over in those conversations. I used to be able to X, but now I can't. I used to be able to go cooking. I used to cook, and now I can't cook anymore because I'm not strong enough to go into the kitchen and stand up and cook anymore. Or I used to, you know, go for walks. There's this wonderful man I spend a lot of time with who was just like one of these really energetic guys, right? And when I started spending time with him, he had COPD, and COPD, among other things, causes your legs to swell quite severely. And he could barely walk anymore. I mean, he could walk with a walker to the bathroom. And that's about as far as his walks went. And he really missed being able to just go for a walk. But that's reality. That's where we're all headed, whether we want to think about it or not. And the reason this is so important, the reason I'm doing this, is just exactly the same thing that the Swami Vishnu said was doing 30, 40 years ago. We don't know how much time we have to practice. We don't know how much time we have before things are going to be to the point where, oh, sitting for half an hour. Yeah, sure. Forget about that. We don't know. And so this is... this story, the classic reasoning behind the story is to sort of encourage us to really get serious about our practice, because we don't know how much longer we have to practice. I mean, how much longer will it be that you can go on a longer retreat before going on a long retreat is just like not going to be part of your life at all? I mean, I think about that a lot because I'm, you know, getting on there, and I did a lot of long retreats early on in my life. And now it's like, oh, I was scheduled to go on one in last June, and not going on it was like, oh my God, who knows if next June, I'll, you know, who knows whether I'll be able to do that. I mean, I sort of like to think I will, but I don't know. We don't have a clue. Here's another part of this issue. And that's that if we're not careful, especially as we get more skillful with our practice, we start using meditation as a way to sort of go beyond the body, escape body sensation. In deep states of concentration, this is exactly what happens. You can go into places where you just don't have much sensation of body at all, or breath. It's just like there's this more purely a mental expression. The physicalness of life dissipates. It's very pleasant. And because it's so pleasant, of course, it's very tempting. But I want to read something This is from Ajahn Sumedho, from his book, The Mind and the Way. The human body is made out of planetary elements, the solid elements, the liquid element, the fire and air. We have to live on the food that grows out of the planet. We need water, we need warmth from the sun, we need air. When our bodies die, their elements are returned to the planet. They don't fall away into heaven. So in this sensory life of living within a human body, we must accept the limitations of the earthly body rather than desire to get out of it and to turn our back on the planet. Such a desire would be a selfish delusion. We would be saying, I don't like this planet. I'm fed up with this body. I'm going to float up into a finer, more ethereal space. Such a desire is based on the illusion of a separate self, on aversion to that separate self, and on the desire to get something better, more refined, or more subtle. This is a movement of desire rather than aspiration. In meditation, one of the most important lessons is to accept the earth and the body. We meditate on the body a lot. In the beginning, meditation is centered on the physical body. We learn how to calm the body and how to live without ignoring the body's needs or trying to bend it to our desires. If we don't understand our bodies, we can be quite brutal and uncaring towards them. For example, when we encounter pain in meditation, we can try to force the body to shut up and stop being painful. We can try to attain a trance-like state in which we just forget the body. But when the body starts becoming painful or hungry, or we have to go to the toilet, then we think the body is disgusting. It's not fair, is it? We just get into these blissful realms, and then suddenly we have to go to the toilet. It's not fair. But in meditation, the aim of contemplating the body is not to take a position for or against the body, but to understand it. It is like this. Bodies are like this, where you're not thinking of it in a personal way. Whether it's attractive or unattractive, we simply see the body as the body. We no longer look at my body in contrast to your body. It is just this body. It feels like this. It is like this. It works like this. When we accept it for what it is, the body does not create many problems. Bodies create a lot of problems when we don't accept them, when we dismiss them, or exalt them, or do something we shouldn't do with them. The body can be pretty wretched, miserable conditions we have to live with, but the body itself is not an obstacle when we accept it, understand it, and know it. Wonderful advice. And that's what I'm talking about, accepting the three messengers, the first three. We accept the first three by practicing the fourth, which is kind of interesting in a way. So now, how can I skillfully work with this teaching in my daily life and in my regular practice? That's the obvious question. I mean, it's okay to sort of understand this, but what is there some form of practice that I can use to work skillfully with this? And there's this really interesting thing called the five remembrances. And this is a teaching that has, you know, I don't know if there's any official words for it. There's lots of different forms. The one I'm about to read you, the five remembrances as written down or as expressed by Thich Nhat Hanh, just because I happen to like the wording he uses, and it has its sort of sweetness of the Thich Nhat Hanh sweetness to it, which is nice because this is a difficult thing. So at least it's a bit sweet while we're dealing with the difficult. Okay. So here's the five remembrances. And the idea is these are things that you would consciously remember every day. That you, I mean, one of my teachers suggested that if you wanted to, you could actually write these five things down, or you know, find them written down. Believe me, if you Google the five remembrances, you'll be flooded with options of wording. So you can find the one that you feel comfortable with. But you actually take this and you sort of have it in your meditation space and read it before you sit. It's one way to work with this, or read it at the end of the day, or read it to you know, when you're having your coffee in the morning, for that matter. Who just they call it the five remembrances because you should remember them every day. This could be part. It could be, if you're inclined in this direction, part of your practice. So here's the five remembrances. I am of the nature to grow old. There's no way to escape growing old. I'm of the nature to have ill health. There's no way to escape ill health. I'm of the nature to die. There's no way to escape death. All that is dear to me and everyone I love are of the nature of to change. There's no way to escape being separated from them. That's a big one, huh? I'll read that one again. All that is dear to me and everyone I love are of the nature to change. There's no way to escape being separated from them. And then finally, my actions are my only true belongings. I cannot escape the consequences of my actions. My actions are the ground upon which I stand. That's the five remembrances. This is a really powerful teaching, because it reminds us very eloquently, I think, exactly where we stand. And it encourages us to practice. I think this is an encouragement to practice. So I know some of you want to write these down. I can repeat them one more time, but I really suggest if you go onto your computer after this is over and just Google the five remembrances, you'll get exactly what I'm reading out loud to you. But I will read them one more time because I know some people love to write things down. So, okay. I'm of the nature to grow old. There's no way to escape growing old. I am of the nature to have ill health. There's no way to escape ill health. I'm of the nature to die. There's no way to escape death. I had a teacher who said, life is a disease with 100% mortality rate. It's a very, very good way to think of this, with a little touch of humor added to it, right? All that is dear to me and everyone I love are of the nature to change. There is no way to escape being separated from them. And finally, my actions are my only true belongings. I cannot escape the consequences of my actions. My actions are the ground upon which I stand. And here's the other interesting thing about this. If we're not careful, we look at these five remembrances and we think of them all as problems. Something wrong. These aren't problems. This is just seeing things as they really are. This is the truth of life. If you look at these things as problems, then you're going to try and struggle against them. You're trying to solve them somehow. And none of them are soluble. None of them are soluble. These aren't problems. These are statements of fact that we just don't want to take in. But that's what they are. They're facts. Just simple facts expressed in a very clear, precise way. And here's the other interesting thing. For an enlightened being, none of these are problems at all. None of them are even like, yeah, sure. This body is going to fall away. Yeah. You know, there's a great quote I love. This is Ramana Maharshi, who was a great saint in India in the last century. And he was a Vedantin, a very devout following. And he ended up getting this sort of enormous throat cancer on the side of his neck that was gradually, in those days, they couldn't do anything about it, choking him to death. And his students were all gathered around, and he was like, they were saying, oh, you know, Guruji, you know, don't go. And he just looked at him and he said, how can I go anywhere? I'm not going anywhere. I mean, his teachings live on, just like the Buddha. I mean, the Buddha, you know, died 2,500 years ago. The Buddha is still around. It's just in a different form. His teachings have lasted 2,500 years. There's no place anybody's going. It's just this separate self is going to disappear, but the essence of whatever you've been is going to be around. Absolute truth. And as I mentioned, I think it was last week I was talking about how enlightenment is a step-by-step process, or maybe it was a couple of weeks ago. Enlightenment sort of isn't like an on-off switch. It's like over time, gradually, we have more and more moments of enlightenment and more moments of understanding. So as we get a deeper understanding, it's less likely we'll think of these things as problems. We'll just see them as what they are. This is nature as it is. This is the fact of being human. They're not problems at all. That's hopefully what the practice will take us to. Okay. So that's all I have to say. We have time for 5 or 6 minutes here, maybe a bit more. I also have a chat, and there's just another message. Oh, okay, I'll get rid of that. So what I would like to suggest is if you have any questions or comments or would like to share anything, this talk sometimes sort of brings up reactive stuff. and that's perfectly normal and okay. And if that's what you want to share, that's perfectly fine. You know, and as always, as I say, if you don't feel like speaking at all, I totally understand. And I won't insist on anybody saying anything at all. Don't feel any pressure to ask questions or make comments or anything. But I'm leaving the space here for you to do so if you want to. Oh, Carolyn. Go ahead, Carolyn.
Well, first I was going to say the whole time, Barry, I was thinking about a Dhamma talk that Joseph Goldstein gave where, and I was going to bring up like the I am subject to old age and I am not exempt, like, and then you read them all. So I was thinking about the whole time. And what's interesting is when I heard that the first time, it was so radical sounding to me. And I don't know if it's because of my age. And so in a way, I mean, I'm not young, but I'm, you know, in theory, I have time in theory. But to me, it was freeing. It was like, I don't have to live in aversion and denial about getting older or getting sick or dying. Like, I don't have to live this existence of not me.
I'm exempt. Yeah,
that was freeing. And I also thought, you know, it makes it easier to conceptualize the present and what I do have, which is right now, and to kind of think when things happen and, you know, life happens and suffering arises. I don't know, for me, it makes it easier to detach with love from it and just be like, is this how I want to spend this moment suffering over an email I don't like, you know, or do I just want to let go a little bit and just be? And to me, that's the uplifting note of this teaching is we have right now. That's what we do have. That's it, you know. So thank you. I really appreciate it.
Oh, good. Thank you. Meredith, go ahead.
Thanks, Carolyn. I wanted to make a comment that was kind of related. And I guess I'll say this is the first time I'm trying this group. Barry, I've been to some of your morning classes. So I thought I would try it out. So I was also a little bit late, so I'm sorry, but thank you for this. And I'm also quite new to learning about meditation and Buddhism. So this is the first time, I'm sort of like Carolyn was mentioning, this is the first time I've ever heard this. And I have to say that what this reminded me of is that I'm currently in the process of going through a divorce. And it reminded me of the moment of realizing I actually have to end my marriage, right? That like things are so bad, I can't try to continue with it as it is. And there's a certain amount of freedom in saying, yeah, this is really what's happening, right? So even if I can't necessarily do anything about it, just say, yeah, I'm being honest about what reality is right now. That can feel kind of relaxing, right? Rather than spending my whole life trying to fight, you know, getting old, maybe I can just say, okay, that's how it's going to be. You know, or okay, like I'm at the point where it's time to get divorced. Like let's go on beyond the point of fighting it. I think it's basically what Carolyn was saying, but I just had a really similar reaction.
Yeah. Yeah. And at the same time, I think it's really important that we do what we can to take care. This isn't an excuse for not taking care of our health and eating healthy and getting lots of exercise and going to the doctor. You know, all those things we do that we're not saying, oh, well, you don't have to do any of that stuff because I'm going to die anyway. Well, no, we're not saying that either. We have to be very careful there that we don't go to the other extreme where we sort of throw up our hands and go, oh, well, it's all, I'm going to die anyway, so who cares? No, we want to maximize this life as best we can, understanding that at a certain point, nothing we're going to do is going to make any difference. Yeah. Yeah. Sari, go ahead.
I have been in a lot of different church traditions throughout my life, and you know, death is talked about at funerals, and I mean, of course, ministers talk about it, but I don't remember hearing it a lot. Of course, the story of Jesus Christ and all that is all about death and rebirth, but it's always struck me about the Buddhist teachings, and now in my church that I have attended. They, you know, I hear those coming into the teachings more. Even my aunt and her, you know, her more conservative church, they're talking about mindfulness and things. It's interesting to see that influence. And I really appreciate this teaching because it's something that I don't think I've really grappled with till, you know, I got older, had that, turned 40 and so my midlife crisis kind of a thing. But I do experience life differently now that I'm older and I think about things. And as a child, I lost my mom when I was 7 and I remember I was really frightened of death. And it was not some, in my family, it was not handled where psychologically I was really a part of it. You know, my dad just wanted to cut it off, kind of. And I had some fears as a little girl about this little mark on my arm and that I was getting cancer. And for years, I just kept that inside. And so anyway, it just made me think about that, which was just something to share. It was just an experience of death. And
You experienced the classic cultural taboo around talking about this stuff. I mean, it's really, this is not something people talk about very much. You know, and if you think about how our culture deals with older people, a lot of times they're put someplace with a bunch of other older people, and this is like a good thing. You know, and it's not, anyhow, I don't want to go there because I'll start to rant. So. But having spent time doing hospice work in some of those places, they're not, some of them are very pleasant. Anyhow, were you waving your hand to speak? Yes.
I just want to say thank you very much for this teaching. It's very timely for me. And thank you.
Okay, good. I think we've run out of things to say. So I will, as always, finish with the poem. I can't do a Dharma talk without a poem. This is from Mary Oliver's book, Evidence. And it speaks to what I've been talking about to a certain extent. It's called Hallelujah. Everyone should be born into this world happy and loving everything. But in truth, it rarely works that way. For myself, I've spent my life clamoring toward it. Hallelujah. Anyway, I'm not where I started. And have you too been trudging like that sometimes, almost forgetting how wondrous the world is and how miraculously kind some people can be? And have you decided that probably nothing important is ever easy? Not, say, for the first 60 years? Hallelujah, I'm 60 now and even a little more. And some days I feel like I have wings. Hallelujah in my case. 60s, long ago. Anyhow, thank you all for your kind attention. I'll just do a simple dedication of merit here. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere.